In today's episode of the Sixers Beat, Rich and I talk to Jake Fisher, a longtime friend, former Liberty Ballers colleague, current NBA reporter for Bleacher Report, and author of Built to Lose: How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever. The book obviously heavily focuses on the 76ers and the process, given their prominence in this conversation, but also discusses rebuilds from the Boston Celtics, Phoenix Suns, Sacramento Kings, and Milwaukee Bucks, while putting all of that in the context of the changing league dynamics. This is an exceptionally well-researched, well-sourced book, which will shed a lot of light and provide significant context for the process, one of the most pivotal periods in franchise history. If you're a Sixers fan and interested in the process, go pick up a copy at triumphbooks.com, Amazon, or wherever books are sold. And if you're not following Jake on Twitter, give him a follow at Jake L. Fisher. That's F-I-S-C-H-E-R. Enjoy the podcast. All right, welcome everybody. This is Derek and Rich, joined by a longtime friend, former colleague, and current author of Built to Lose: How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever, Jake Fisher. How you doing, Jake?
Doing well, guys. How are you?
I'm doing okay. It's been a minute. You know, we haven't seen each other in person for, I haven't seen very many people in person for the last year. Yeah. So it is great to catch up. This is a book that I have been waiting on for a little bit now. We met a little, while you were working on it, we were both in Denver. So we had a chance to catch up there. Probably the last time I've seen you in person, I believe, right?
I think so. Yeah, I think so.
Cause there the only event that was still going on between there and the lockdown would have been the All-Star game. And yeah.
You know, actually I did take a trip down to Philly for the Golden State game when Joel came out with the Kobe number 24 jersey to talk to D'Angelo. So I might have seen you guys then. But yeah, that was like a couple weeks before everything happened. And you know, if you are looking to hang out in person, I've been told to make my pitches at the top of these things. Monday, May 10th, 4 to 6 p.m. at my friend's new bar, Liberty Grounds. Kyle Newbeck's going to be there with me. You guys can definitely come too. I'm going to have a little distance book signing for anybody who's got their copy already, and I'll have like four on hand to buy, not too many, but yeah, Monday, come through, everybody.
That's great.
Love it.
I need an autograph on my copy as well, and I'm fully vaxxed up and ready to go.
Yeah, I've got my two vaxes, so that's why we're getting out in the streets and shaking hands and kissing babies.
Coming up, I am not going to turn down very many offers to catch up or get drinks because I've been a shut-in for a year, as everyone else, and it's been way too long. But going back, you know, I think this is interesting for a number of reasons. First, it's great just to have you on because, like I said, known you for, 7, 8 years now at this point. Former colleague, great guy. We're both old now.
Another member of the Liberty Ballers 2014 to 16 class. What a staff. Sure.
A dynasty, a dynastic group.
I might be a little bit biased, but I agree with that. I agree with that.
Well, I tell people all the time, and this is a good like segue for this book, everything, like we would have access to the SB Nation metrics all around the league, right? And the Sixers were the worst team in the league by all accounts, right? The polarizing, awful black eye on the league, but we were ranking first or second pretty much every day in SB Nation metrics among all the team blogs. Now, a credit to how good we were, I think, not to pat ourselves on the back too much, but also a credit to how interesting what the thing was we were covering.
The team was a lightning rod. It was very interesting, very debatable, and that certainly helped us, but that is also what we're talking about in this book. So let's take a step back. Again, Built to Lose: How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever. What is the overall, I guess, arc of the story you're telling? What is the topic that you were discussing? What is a general overview of the book?
I think the overall arc starts with the fact that around 2012, you know, with Rob Hennigan leaving the Thunder after the Thunder's finals appearance to Orlando, and then Hinkie being hired in Philly and Ryan McDonough going to Phoenix and Pete D'Alessandro in Sacramento and David Griffin coming to power in Cleveland. You know, it really wasn't just Sam. All these analytical minded executives coming to power kind of realized that it's not, we can't mess around anymore. Like the league is either about competing for a title or nothing. And the only way to do that is to have multiple All-Stars on your roster. And the most direct path to do so is by getting them at the top of the draft, like Oklahoma City did in that 2012, before they got to the 2012 finals, and like the Heat, you know, they had Dwayne Wade, and then Dwayne Wade attracted LeBron and Chris Bosh. And coincidentally, while the Heat were running the league and they were supposed to win not five, not six, not seven, all these execs thought, you know, the 2014 draft class is supposed to be the next great class since that 03 class that created LeBron and Wade and Bosh and Melo. And we might as well wait out that Heat dynasty. We'll get our next generation of guys, and by the time they're out, we'll be running the league too. And that's kind of what we've seen in Philly. I mean, Boston did it. People forget KG and Paul Pierce were traded to Brooklyn the same exact night Hanky moved Drew to New Orleans for Nerlens. And I know Phoenix didn't think that Devin Booker would be the guy, but sure enough, you know, they get Devin, they get DeAndre Ayton, and then they attract Chris Paul, and now they're a one seed too. So the benefits were obvious, and we're seeing them come to fruition today.
So, Jake, that let's go specifically to the Sixers on this point, because you know you touch a lot on this in the book, and I think you know I know our audience and kind of the general Sixers fan audience that they'd be interested in this. When you did reporting on how the Sixers landed on Brett Brown, that is interesting to me, just because you know before that 2014 draft class, there were a lot of losses that had to accumulate first. You have to make it through a season without hopefully things going haywire, which in the Sixers case, you know, they were hit or miss on, but you know, I guess they made it to the end of the road. So what did you learn about kind of the process on settling on Brett Brown and what the Sixers were looking for there?
Yeah, with the coaching search and with everything, you know, I talked to over 300 people for this book, from players to like Darius Johnson. I didn't talk to Darius Johnson Odom, but players like those guys. I talked to Tim Frazier, to Thaddeus Young, to you know GMs and execs all around the league, and it's just full of original reporting and storytelling that you're not going to find anywhere else. And part of that, and a lot of some of these details were in Yaron's book, Tanking to the Top. But I mean, I really think I've got a full autopsy of Sam coming in and rallying up the makeshift start of his front office and just kind of canvassing everybody and saying, you know, who could be a potential head coach one day that's not a head coach right now, and how do we get in touch with them? And they created this expansive list from like Lloyd Pierce got on the list because Aaron Barzilay, who was the team's first kind of analytical minded guy under this new Josh Harris ownership at the time, they were new, you know, and he had overlapped with Lloyd Pierce in Memphis. And he was like, you know, this guy's got a shot one day, let's bring him in. And one thing that I thought was really interesting from talking to a couple of candidates, I talked to Jay Larinaga from Boston and Adrian Griffin, who was a Bulls assistant at the time, and a couple other people who didn't want to go on record, but just gave me some info. Sam didn't use that opportunity to pick those guys' brains to get in, like inside secrets from other teams. That's what most execs do. They like make an expansive list kind of to like extract info from rivals. But Sam wanted to get to know these guys just like they were draft prospects, which I thought was fascinating. And he would just walk up to people in summer league. Like he came up to Jay Larinaga in Orlando and said, "Hey man, let's go to dinner." And they went to dinner for like 5 hours and just talked basketball and philosophy and whatnot. But the really curious thing to me was after he reached out to those people originally, he went dark. And that's from talking to head coaching candidates, to scout candidates, to like little lower level front office type people. That was kind of Sam's MO. He would just go off the grid and not really circle back, to the point where Jay Larinaga, for example, was supposed to be Brad Stevens' number two in Boston. And throughout that summer, he kept looking and saying, "Hey, Brad kept saying to Jay, like, are you going to be here? Are you going to Philly? Like, what's up?" And Jay was like, "I don't know. I guess maybe I'm out of the mix." And then sure enough, like late August, they wrapped it up and they came up with their five-man list. They brought them all into New York and gave them this whole tour around the ownership group offices. And it finished up at Joshua Harris has this like palatial estate somewhere by Central Park in Manhattan.
Of course he does.
And it was Jay Larinaga told me that like it's really impressive. This conference room like has a whole view of like all the trees in the park, like brimming out over all the high rises and stuff. And they just talked. And what Adrian Griffin told me was that Sam was asking questions to kind of like prove to ownership that these guys could project into something, just like a player, just like Nerlens or Embiid or NCW or whoever was going to be like a 3-year, 2-year project. That's what he was selling his coaches on too. And one thing that was really interesting was that they were ownership was not budging on a 3-year contract. Like they needed to have a 3-year deal. But Brett Brown, from what PJ Carlissimo told me, his former Spurs friend of his, that Brett was like adamant about getting that 4th extra year. He didn't want to be Mark Jackson, right? Where Steve Kerr comes in and takes over and leads that team to a finals run like in his very first year. And Brett, by all accounts, just emerged, sorry for the long answer, just emerged as the guy, being that he has this extensive player development history, which if you guys want to hear more about some Spurs stories, I could tell you that too. But he emerged as the guy who was going to be this nurturer, this kind of like kindergarten teacher almost, but at an NBA level. And that's why I think he really emerged amongst everybody else. He was considered by everyone in the league the best player development guy. And that's what Sam needed. He needed somebody to turn these guys into stars.
That's so fascinating that he didn't even care about the other team's secrets. He's like, we're a few years away from needing the other team's secrets. We gotta just develop what we have from the ground up. So yeah, I mean, they settle on Brett. Did I guess, you know, I know this is somewhat in the book, but you know, that first year is probably something that we gloss over a little bit just because,
definitely,
you know, they won 10 games, or what was it? 10. Yeah. 10 games 2 years later, you know, you had the Fultz stuff, but the first year was kind of the, you know, the holdovers from the Doug Collins era who had not been moved on yet. And then they, you know, they had their younger players. They had MCW, they had Nerlens who did not play that first year. I guess that this is in the book, but I guess like big picture takeaways on what the holdovers kind of thought about being part of, you know, this tanking experiment that the Sixers were undertaking after being kind of a average-ish playoff team.
Yeah, I think at the beginning, Spencer Hawes told me he was pretty psyched when Brett came in, because Brett and a lot of the players, just like traditionally throughout Doug Collins' career, a lot of them were over Doug, right? He just grates on people after a certain extent.
I was over Doug.
And yeah, and I mean, ownership was too, obviously. So when Brett came in, he was, you know, this youthful type energy, and he pushed the guys to shoot threes, which Doug obviously wasn't willing to do. So at the beginning, like, Spencer Hawes was pumped. Thad was pumped. But you're right, like, that 3-0 start really took the city by storm. I remember we were kind of freaking out at Liberty Ballers. Like, what are we, good.
Stop winning. They're
too good. Yep.
But Thad told me after that first game, like, he knew they were bad. And Brett was, throughout training camp and the preseason, he was reaching out to the guys and bringing them into his office and saying, like, you know, we're just trying to get better every day. We're not really here to do anything but that. And that message was great for a guy like Khalif Wyatt, but you're right, for Spencer and Thad and Evan, like, they were all trying to get out. And there's funny details of, like, Evan Turner at a certain point, he found Brad Stevens in the hallway between the locker rooms, both in TD Garden and at the center. And he was, cause he had some prior relationship with Brad Stevens and was like, Brad, please trade for me. Thad Young, remember, he put in this trade request, which I actually, not to toot my own horn, reported back then.
I remember that.
And he denied it publicly, but in the book, I mean, we met up in a hotel in the city sometime, I guess, in the 2018 to 2020 range. And he was like, oh, yeah, I requested it. I don't want to be there anymore. And remember that January, the early December, or the late December, early January Disney on Ice road trip, Dad was just putting up 30 and 29 and whatever. He was like, I'm definitely trying to audition to get out of here. But one thing that they were all super frustrated by, Evan Turner especially, Sam didn't really take the time to develop relationships with them. And I think from his perspective, and from what I've been told from people around the team, was that it was by design. Like, he didn't want to get to know those guys too well and have his personal relationship impact his trade negotiations. And that definitely rubbed the players the wrong way. Like, Evan at one point, jokingly like saw Sam walk by the practice facility and was like, "Hey Sam, we play for the Sixers." And
that Spencer, sounds like
him. Yeah, and Spencer's agent, Greg Lawrence at the time, was always calling Sam, and I remember he told me as the deadline got closer, he felt like Sam really bit off more than he could chew. He was trying to just negotiate, and get as much as he could. Evan was getting – part of why Evan went to Brad was because he had heard that Chicago was interested in him after Derrick Rose got hurt again. But Sam was like, "You got to give me 2 first-round picks for him," which, again, the 2014 class was considered to be the next 2003 class. So who's giving up 2 first-round picks for Evan Turner? Like, there was definitely frustration from those guys that they might not have gotten moved because he was holding out for so much. And that did happen with that, right? Like, he was still around after the deadline because – Sam never got the first rounder that he wanted for him.
I actually remember Hawes. This is kind of an aside, but the game before he got traded that year,
yes,
was against the Cavs at home. I don't think I've ever seen, like, people are a little frustrated with how the Sixers are playing now while they're winning and not really trying. I don't think I've ever seen a player not trying a game like that in my life before.
Yeah. We can curse on this, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Let him play.
Zach Lowe famously called it, or said he didn't look like Spencer. It was a masterpiece of not giving a fuck. And when I got Spencer on the phone and asked him, like, "Did you give a fuck?" He was like, "No, absolutely not." And he told me what was funny. So that deadline day, Thursday, like always, Evan actually went to the facility and practiced. And Brett ran them ragged because they had given such a poor effort against Cleveland. And Spencer was like, "Nah, fuck it. I'm not even going." He woke up and went to, I forget the name of it, but some bar down, I think in Rittenhouse, or in Old City somewhere, where he used to always go. He knew the bartender pretty well. The bartender, like, wrapped him up in a hug, and he was, like, crying. He was like, "Where are you going to go, man?" Spencer was like, "I don't know, but I can't wait to get the hell out of here." And another funny thing was, at the trade, right the week before that, at the All-Star break, Spencer and Evan were supposed to go to Puerto Rico to meet girlfriends on vacation, but there was, like, inclement weather and their plane could never get out. So they ended up just, like, camping out in Spencer's house and, like, drinking all the alcohol he had left over. And at a certain point, they had ran out of toilet paper, and, like, their, like, mini quarantine that they were doing. And that's what led to Evan finding this Barack Obama toilet paper stash that Spencer Hawes had and posting on Instagram, which, like, made it seem like that's what Spencer used. But the real story is just that they got really drunk. They ran out of toilet paper, and this one gag gift that Spencer had gotten around the holidays, because he is a Republican, that was the only toilet paper they had left. So that's why Evan, you know, put it on Instagram.
Yeah, that is, Spencer Hawes was definitely quite the character.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service that you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, so let's move on a little bit to the Embiid draft, because obviously this was a pivotal, maybe might have changed the direction of the franchise.
Just a little bit.
What was your overall reporting on, you know, what their thought process was going into it, what they were taking into consideration in that draft, and how that was received maybe within the organization?
Yeah, I mean, I think across the league, from the get-go, it was Andrew Wiggins and Jabari Parker. But by January, everyone really realized that Joel was the prize and the crown jewel. And, I mean, I remember that Iowa State game. Fred Hoiberg came out afterwards, the head coach then of the Cyclones, and was like, "This is the greatest college player I've ever seen." And Sam definitely agreed, for sure. And he hurt his back, obviously, that ended his freshman year. But, you know, from there, he had this Wasserman workout in California where he was dunking from, like, the foul line and tearing down the rim. And everyone was like, "Holy shit, this guy is really the guy." But he was only going to work out for Cleveland first. And, you know, sure enough, Cavs officials to this day maintain that Joel broke his foot during that Cavs workout, which was remarkable, being that he was by far the best. It was the best workout that David Griffin had ever seen. And he, you know, he'd wowed all the Cavs brass, and they were going to be the guy. But then he got hurt, and Milwaukee didn't want to take him either, because I mean, Mark Lazary on the record in my book said, like, we wanted to make the postseason, and they weren't going to take Embiid because they wanted to make the playoffs, and they thought Jabari was ready made to be a scorer. They even thought Jabari was going to be better than Giannis. Embiid just was right there at three. I mean, Philly coveted him so much that they were definitely trying to trade up for one with Cleveland to get that top pick. And they even considered at a certain point trading down to number five with Utah, because Utah had 5 and 23, because Embiid only gave his medical records to the top three teams, and then Boston down at 6 and the Lakers down at 7. So they kind of knew that those other teams would be very precarious to take a 7'2" guy whose freshman year ended with a broken back, and now he had a broken foot without getting his medical information. But at the end of the day, Philly was going to take Embiid no matter what. The only real candidate that they had outside of Embiid was Dante Exum, you know, the international man of mystery at the time from Australia. There was the Brett Brown connection, where Brett had coached his father, Cecil. And there was a lot of pressure in the organization to take him because he just was young and talented, and MCW, as much as he was the rookie of the year, like, wasn't a real point guard necessarily with the shooting and all that. But they brought in Dante for a secret private workout, and they handed his agent, Rob Pelinka, at the time, a list of all these second round undrafted type guys to go one-on-one with, which, right, is unheard of. Like, we never, ever hear of top guys doing that. But sure enough, they got Tim Frazier into PCOM, and Dante and Tim went one-on-one. And, you know, top five pick versus an undrafted guy, it's supposed to be a blowout, right? But Tim Frazier kicked the shit out of Dante Exum. Just worked him like a senior in high school, beating a freshman that came up for varsity practice. And right then and there, a lot of people around the team told me that immediately took Dante out of the equation. And they weren't even considering him at number 10 later on, actually. I really think so. And Embiid just, he was always going to be the guy, but that Frazier workout really cemented it, that Joel was going to be their number three pick.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, because there's been a lot of misreporting on the Sixers. And then, you know, I think at one point, certainly I think Brett Brown thought they were getting Wiggins. And certainly, I mean, I think the team probably thought they were getting Wiggins at three because they didn't expect Joel Embiid to fall.
Yeah, before he got hurt, too. Before he got hurt, you know, they really thought it was going to go Embiid, Parker, Wiggins, because even 100%. Before Wiggins was going one, the Bucks wanted Parker over Wiggins because he's from Chicago. And again, the playoffs, like, Wiggins had a greater long-term ceiling, they thought, but Jabari was the finished product. So they would have definitely gotten Wiggins if Embiid went one. I'm pretty confident in that.
Is unbelievable. Like, the Bucks would win 10 championships in a row if they didn't have that stupid calculus about a guy from Chicago and thinking he's better than Giannis and all this stuff. It's and making the playoffs the next year.
That's why I love the draft, right? Because you can have a forward-thinking organization that gets a lot of credit for drafting Giannis where they did, and they deserve a lot of credit for drafting Giannis where they did. And also, they thought Jabari Parker was a better addition to their team than even an injured Joel Embiid. And you could have had a like you said, a dynasty, an unstoppable dynasty by one decision. And they chose that sort of short-term playoff push and a misevaluation of Parker, and that got in the way of it.
But the going other back funny to, thing, to, just not to cut it up, but to the context with Milwaukee, too. Remember, a couple of years later, they surprised everybody and took a long-term project in Thon Maker at number 10. So they were clearly all across the board.
Yeah. But it's good to bring up the trading up to one, because I've seen some people report that they were talking with Cleveland to trade up to one for Wiggins. Absolutely not the case. Joel Embiid was number one on almost all teams' boards before he got injured. But from what I've been told, even after the injury, if the Sixers had the number one pick, I truly believe they would have taken Embiid, even injured, even with the foot.
I agree.
But there's just no reason to trade up the one after the injury, because they were pretty confident he was going to fall. The trading down to five was interesting. Would have been a little, like, you can say before the draft or coming into the draft, all right, Orlando's not going to take him. I think it was Utah who they would have traded up to from five. They're not going to take him, but boy, that could have been risky. I think is Sam getting a tiny bit too cute. But it is interesting that they were so confident that he would have lasted the five, and they were so locked in on Embiid that they were willing to entertain it.
I don't think I wrote this in the book, but I think part of the traction of getting 23 was I definitely wrote this in the book. They were trying to trade up to 8 with Sacramento, and I think it was, by all accounts, to try to get Nick Stauskas. And maybe that 23 pick would have been extra ammunition to move up from 10, because I don't know what their offer was to Sacramento, but whatever their offer was to get from 8 up to 10, the Kings said no. So maybe that 23 pick would have been extra ammo to get Nick at number 8.
Well, they end up getting the better player at 10 anyway.
I think you're right about that, Jake, because we actually got inside the Kings war room with that Grantland documentary that year. And there is a mention, I believe. I haven't watched that in a while. It's still one of my favorite videos of all time.
For me, Stauskas.
But I do remember, I think it was Pete D'Alessandro going to Vivek, like, Philly is trying to trade up for the pick. And, you know, whether it was like seconds or whatever. And Vivek was like, no way, we're not doing that. We're taking Stauskas.
Yeah, yes, exactly. There's a lot of Sacramento in the book. I mean, this is a good opportunity to kind of just give them a selling point pitch. It's not just Philly. I mean, I cover a lot of different teams to kind of show that there's different styles of doing this, right? Like Boston moved on before it was too soon, or before it was too late with KG and Paul Pierce. Orlando did the same thing with Dwight. But the Lakers, you know, tried to hold on to Kobe as long as possible instead of maybe moving on from him, and they still ended up kind of tanking. The Kings are kind of, the worst case example of, they were never bad enough to get into that top tier, but they weren't good enough to get into the playoffs, and they just were on this treadmill of mediocrity forever. And they were definitely considering, I mean, they also were behind everybody else analytically. They didn't really have a whole analytic staff and a database and whatnot. Like, they brought in the whole draft 3.0, these like guys off the street, pretty much off Twitter. They were definitely between Elfrid Payton and Nick Stauskas. So they wanted Stauskas at the end of the day. Obviously, they took him over Payton. But it's interesting that everyone has different varying ideas in the same exact draft of who's better and who's not. And they really wanted Stauskas for certain reasons, his ability to shoot off the dribble, and the other things. The coaching staff wanted Elfrid Payton defensively. They really thought they needed to improve defensively in order to compete for the postseason at a certain point. But you're right. Vivek was the driving force for Nick. He was just like enamored by his shooting. And there was like some fact that Nick said he could shoot 99 of 100 free throws just in his backyard, and Vivek would always tell people in the organization, like, he can shoot 99 out of 100 free throws. It's like really, really interesting to see how owners get so involved in certain situations.
Yeah. Wrapping up the 2014 draft, you had some information there about Šarić, and that they had actually promised his agent or his father? I think his agent, right? Misko?
I think everybody. Yeah.
Yeah, they had promised that if he was there, they would take him, and then they ended up taking Elfrid Payton. So I guess just walk us through how everything went on there.
Yeah, I think they were casting a really wide net at 10. Like, they even brought in Jusuf Nurkić at one point, and like, he blew them away, but they thought it was a little bit too risky maybe because of his weight issues at the time. Šarić at the time was someone that everyone kind of loved. Like, he was, you know, He was what he is. He was a hustler, a guy with energy, and he was overwhelmingly a Brett Brown type of guy, like leave it all out on the floor. And he really reminded everyone of the organization, like Boris Diaw. But you're right, Dario was sitting in Barclays. Number 10 comes around. He's ready to go, and they hear Elfrid Payton's name get called, and he's freaking out. Elfrid Payton is excited, but remember, Michael Carter-Williams was there on the floor for ESPN, and he's like, oh, I don't know what's happening. The ESPN broadcast on the Jumbotron pan to his face, and he looks like he's seen his own ghost, and they have to take this picture together, remember? And Elfrid's all smiling, but Michael's like, I don't know what's happening here. And, you know, depending on who you talk to, you know, Sam definitely had inside information from Orlando that they wanted Elfrid Payton. And obviously they had a hold of one of Philly's future picks from that Dwight Howard four-team deal that brought Andrew Bynum to the situation. And he wanted to get that pick back. And he knew they wanted Elfrid, and he kind of held him hostage. Now, people still say to this day that they thought Elford would have been, you know, just a guy that would have been good to have in your program regardless. But they took him fully expecting Dario to be available at 12. And they knew that Orlando wanted Elford, and they knew that they would be able to extract him from Orlando and get an extra pick out of the process too. So it was a pretty ballsy move, and it paid off for Sam.
Yeah, definitely
what a masterpiece that draft is. My God. I mean, yeah. He certainly had his hits and misses at the top of the draft. That was pretty flawless.
Well, it to me, it's always because I hear a lot of people say, well, they got lucky. They didn't even want Embiid. He fell to 3. Well, that's not true. They didn't want Embiid. And something I've said in the past, and certainly your reporting here is more detailed than anything we've seen. They were locked in on Embiid, but they were very lucky that he fell to 3 because they were never going to be able to trade up the number one. If Embiid doesn't get hurt,
never.
Cleveland is not trading that pick. At least not for another draft prospect. Maybe they will to entice LeBron James, but not for another draft prospect. So they are lucky that he got injured and fell to 3, but they were very much like that to me is a clear delineation of priorities and showing which teams I think had their eye on what mattered when you compare what the Bucks did versus what the Sixers did. And the Sixers were never passing on Joe. I don't believe they would have. And your reporting, I think, certainly suggests that.
Yeah.
So it is an interesting draft for sure. The next draft, not quite as interesting, not quite as much of a hit. So I guess just the overall sense of the team, where they were at, what sort of like the, I hate to use this word because it's become the word of the year, but the vibe of the team and how everything was going on and how that influenced the selection that you think.
Well,
of Okafor, of course, I'm talking about.
Yes. Well, we have to think, there's a lot of context to play here. Obviously, you know, Nerlens sat out that first year and MCW rises to the rookie of the year. And they're supposed to have this blueprint of Nerlens, MCW, and Embiid, right? That, you know, PR campaign they put out to season ticket holders, the blueprint to success. Then they trade MCW at the trade deadline. And it caused a whole uproar amongst a lot of people in the organization and the fan base too. And when Embiid gets hurt again, right before the 2015 draft, there was starting the sense of pressure, I think, that ultimately ended up pushing Sam out the door was starting to get felt, I think, by a lot of people in the organization. And, you know, Jahlil Okafor was the number one guy all that year long until same thing as Embiid, kind of around January, February, Karl Anthony Towns kind of emerged as the number one pick. But even still, everyone thought Jahlil was just right there, probably going to go number two. And the Lakers thought so. They brought Ja in for 2 workouts. They also brought in D'Angelo and Kristaps Porzingis and Emmanuel Mudiay. And, you know, I mentioned Kristaps to say that I think Philly was really intrigued by him. But Andy Miller, who represented Nerlens, had a whole interesting whole rookie year there where he wasn't showing up on time for medical evaluations. He was late to the team plane taking off. You know, they considered hiring like a full-time babysitter, honestly, for Nerlens. That whole situation wasn't the same degree with Joel. He wasn't nearly as much of a malcontent as Nerlens at his rookie year. But, I mean, his brother died, and he was, you know, considered like an outcast on the team. This, like, training room sideshow of trying to keep his weight under wraps and whatnot. And I think when Joel broke his foot again, they really started to feel the pressure on, you know, the longest view in the room was what everyone, you know, really had their calling card and really, you know, was proud of to be a part of. But I think the pressure started to sink in then. They couldn't take Porzingis. Andy Miller never let Sam Hinkie talk to him. When they had their workout in Las Vegas, he made ASM staffers, that their agency at the time, like, he basically sent a message to everyone in the agency, do not let Hinkie talk to Porzingis. They wouldn't let him work out in Philly. They scheduled a lunch meeting at one point in New York for Hinkie to meet Porzingis. And as Hinkie was driving up, Miller said, like, oh, he's got food poisoning, don't come. And just like with Utah or Orlando not really being able to take Embiid without having his medical records, Porzingis was this, you know, unheard of 7'2", 7'3", whatever, Lithuanian prospect who, not Lithuanian, Latvian prospect, excuse me, who, you know, they wanted to see if his body would hold up. And there was just no way ownership was going to be able to approve taking him without any access to him at all. So at that point in time, you know, they did want D'Angelo, but he went number two to the Lakers. They were considering Emmanuel Mudiay, but they ended up taking Ja, I think, for multiple reasons. I think it was kind of Embiid insurance, number one. Like, he got hurt a week or whatever before the draft and potentially was never going to play. Like, that was a real, real concern for a lot of people in the organization, and they viewed Ja as a potential band-aid for that situation. And the other worst-case scenario was Ja was considered the number one prospect forever, right? They thought he was at least going to have maximum trade value of any guy available there. But sure enough, you know, the whole Boston situation reared its ugly head that November right around Thanksgiving. And, you know, the ending of the process era kind of started from there.
So let's, you know, let's compare what you know about the Sixers and all the reporting you did with the other teams. I guess, you know, this is kind of a broader question. You could take it a bunch of different ways. What do you view as the pluses and minuses of what the Sixers did? Kind of scorched earth,
yeah.
Young guys, you know, making no mistake about trying to be the worst team versus some of the like soft tanks, you know, like you talked about, you know, the Kings just not kind of almost being in tanking no man's land, other teams mm-hmm. like that. What do you think the pluses and minuses of the Sixers compared to some of those other strategies were?
Go to the 2015 trade deadline again. When Philly moves on from MCW, Boston, they're trading for Isaiah Thomas and they make the playoffs. And I think that's the most traditional tank. Like Utah did it in 2014 too. They tanked 1 year. And they got Exum obviously didn't become the guy, but you know, then they started making their way back to the playoff picture. And with Boston, they were able to start collecting talent and eventually put themselves in the position to sign Gordon Hayward and Al Horford in free agency. And they got to the conference finals, you know, quicker than Philly did. But the other benefit to what Philly did is they have more staying power right now, ostensibly, right? Like they built it more organically, patiently. And I think one thing that was important to characterize what Sam's strategy was they never had this hubris that they were going to draft better than everybody else. The draft is a very unpredictable science, and you never know what's going to happen with Cleveland and Milwaukee ahead of you. You never know what's going to happen with Minnesota and the Lakers ahead of you. Like, I really think if the Lakers take Jahlil Okafor, you know, D'Angelo Russell's the point guard of the future in Philly. And who knows how that would have turned out. So there's all these unexpected variables that come into play. And I think what Sam's strategy was, it was designed to mitigate as many of those unforeseen variables as possible. And I mean, Embiid's injury is a perfect example, right? Like he missed his first 2 years and sure enough, here he is now. But the other thing I think is important to talk about here is that if Joel doesn't get hurt or get hurt his second year after they drafted him, I don't think the process would have been, I don't think they would have won 10 games only in 15-16. I don't think the plan was to be as bad as they were for as long as they were, because they were hiring people like Chris Babcock and Todd Wright, who had connections to Kevin Durant from Texas. And they had, and Lloyd Pierce had a connection with LeBron, and Kyle Lowry had a big connection with Billy Lane, the assistant they hired from Villanova. Like, Sam was doing sneaky things like that to set Philly up to be in the conversation for free agents starting in 2016. So I don't think they were really intentionally going to do what they did for the first three seasons of Sam's – I mean, the only three seasons of Sam's tenure. I think it's just the circumstances that came to play – led them to being bad for that long, but that's also how it was designed, right? They had the opportunity to have that long view.
Yeah, outside of the Okafor pick, I think one of the things that the Sixers did well, I guess, or, you know, whether you want to say they did well, it definitely worked out in the long term, is that they didn't, once something started to go wrong, they didn't take any shortcuts. They said, we're going to take our medicine for another year. And, you know, it really set them up to a place where they could mess up a decent amount of stuff and still have that staying power you talked about. Yeah, the D'Angelo Russell thing, that would have been interesting. You know, it would have probably given the Sixers a better fit. I'm not sure it would have given them, like, that much better of a player, but certainly probably would have worked out better than than Okafor did. And also, Swaggy P might still be in a relationship, too.
Yeah. The D'Angelo Russell thing was really interesting because his mentality and his maturity was really a factor that everyone was thinking of.
Yeah.
Especially in L.A.
Like, how would that have happened in Philly, too? Like, he had Kobe on that team, right, in L.A. Mm-hmm. when it started? Not to say, you know, but like, look, that's still different than what the Sixers were dealing with, you know, having to bring in Elton Brand, you know, at the midpoint of the season just to get an adult in the room.
Yeah. I mean, the Elton Brand situation is really interesting. And, you know, the Duke ties to Sam, the Duke theme throughout Sam's demise, I think is really fascinating too, with, and we can get into this if you want.
I think that's interesting that you brought it, 'cause that's something I'd uncovered during, some of my research on my book, which you, there's a strong suspicion that, Coach K was at least involved in urging Adam Silver to look at the Philly situation.
You've heard that too?
I heard that too, which is great to see, you know, cross-reference a bit between our books, and great to see that it was confirmed and you've done more reporting on it. So it is interesting, the Duke connection, because that came through a lot in the latter stages of Sam's tenure, for sure.
It did. I mean, Adam Silver's college roommate at Duke is a partner or someone at Apollo Global, where Joshua Harris obviously comes from. And, you know, Elton Brand is a Duke guy. Jahlil Okafor is a Duke guy. Jerry Colangelo was the USA basketball chairman, who Mike Krzyzewski was the coach for at the time. So a lot of these things that end up coming to light later on, like, the connections are pretty obvious when you really spell them out.
Yeah, there was, I don't think anybody had any real proof, but there was certainly a sneaking suspicion that there was involvement there. Yeah. I guess one thing that, go here and then pivot towards an end question. The Hanky specials and how much that became a point of contention with agents. I guess, first of all, you know, what was a lot of there? Because it's not like other teams weren't offering things, but there was a key aspect that Sixers weren't offering that other teams were in those four-year deals. But what was the point of contention? And then also, one of the interesting things I thought was Christian Wood, that they had offered him a four-year deal, and it sounded like he was agreeable to it, and then that fell apart. So I guess first overall Hinkie special, and then also what happened with Christian Wood and Sam's relationship with him and possibly bringing him back.
The first thing I want to say about the Hinkie special that I think's kind of gotten lost to history is, with that and the 10-day contracts, I don't think Sam gets enough credit for giving a lot of players an opportunity to make the NBA that wouldn't have gotten it otherwise. Like, we talked about Tim Frazier at the top. I mean, he was in the D League. He was the MVP of the D League, I think, I'm pretty sure. At least he was an all-star that 13-14 season before he came into Philly, and then he signed with Portland, and he's still kicking around. I mean, guys like Robert Covington, TJ McConnell. I mean, he gave everyone, I mean, from Darius Johnson Odom to Jarvis Farnado to Daniel Orton, he gave a lot of guys opportunities. But the point of contention was that Sam was selling that opportunity as a means to not pay those guys very much. And very much, I mean, for TJ McConnell to get, you know, an $800,000 salary out of school, pretty incredible. But that ultimately locks you into a deal, and there's no flexibility at all. And at the same point in time, when LeBron went back to Cleveland, and that has its ripple effects throughout the tanking time period that we're talking about, obviously Cleveland was picking one at the top of the draft, like we've discussed, and that was really LeBron possibly even entertaining going back to Cleveland was definitely on their minds the whole draft process. But also, when LeBron went back to Akron for his offseason, for his meetings he was taking with players or with agents and teams, Rich Paul told everybody, like, he's taking his max. Like, the Heat guys had all taken a little bit less to play together and, you know, whatever. But LeBron realized, like, if I'm not taking my max salary, how can anybody else take their max salary? So that became a big push throughout the agenting world and the union. Like, everyone started to say, on the flip side of this, the Hinkie special is literally lowering the bar and lowering the competitive, you know, balance, I guess, for the lack of a better expression, for all agents out there. Jeremy Grant was on the record in the book saying it's an awful deal. Like, you can out, like, pretty much everybody who is going to make it to that fourth year of the non-guaranteed deal, like, you're gonna automatically have outplayed it, because you're still sticking around the NBA and you were not really even gonna have an opportunity. And the players union in 2015 actually, I mean, every summer the union has agent meetings where they kind of address things they want to talk about and change or whatever. They were telling agents, do not sign this contract. It is terrible for our marketplace. It is terrible for our union. It pushes guys to take less money and get locked into bad deals. But for someone like TJ, it's attractive. For someone like Christian Wood, it might have been attractive, but you're right. He did ultimately spurn that at a certain point because they thought he could have gotten more at a certain point. Robert Covington didn't take it. He was going to take, or Hinkie called his agent in the 2013 draft in the second round and said, if we draft you, will you be open to this deal? And they said no.
And that was pretty high, right? I think that was the 35th pick you said.
35th pick, yeah. So
that's crazy. I knew he was interested in Covington as an undrafted. I didn't realize he almost got drafted that high, though.
Yeah, and the only reason they didn't draft him was because they knew Covington wasn't going to take that contract. So it was pretty perilous. There were, I see both sides of it. Dwayne Dedman, remember, he was someone that came in into that season, and Brett Brown was really a big fan of him and wanted him to be around for a while. And Hinkie wouldn't budge off of his deal. And his agent, Mike Silverman, was like, dude, we're going to get more guaranteed money from somebody. Like, Silverman said he respected Hinkie for like resting on his laurels and being a staunch negotiator, but he was never backing off of it. And it drove a lot of people nuts.
Yeah. Interesting. Because if they could have just, I mean, to be honest, Christian Wood wasn't ready to be an NBA productive player at 2016. I think he needed some time to bounce around to get to where he was, but that would have been interesting if they could have kept him around. Interesting that they had that much interest in him too, because they brought him in for a pair of 10 days and you thought, well, boy, they missed the talent. Yeah. But it sounds like they had pretty legitimate interest.
Well, so he also had he also had an interesting overlap with Ja in Boston, right? He was right then and there in the middle of that whole thing.
Yeah.
Thanksgiving morning.
Yeah. Fun times. All right. So I guess let's just wrap this up with a sort of general, you know, where do you think Hinkie could have made the biggest change that would have prevented what ended up happening? What was his sort of like fatal flaw? What was his thing that he needed to fix in order to maintain power?
I think on the ground and behind the scenes, that aggressive negotiating style that we just talked about and how he, you know, wasn't very personable with certain guys like Evan Turner and Spencer Hawes and Thad, like we've talked about, rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. I mean, the Andre Kirilenko situation in 2015 was honestly, I mean, I'm a big fan of Sam's, but learning about that situation kind of made me have a gut check about his strategy at a certain point. I mean, Kirilenko had a wife, his wife was having a really awful pregnancy situation, and they were in Brooklyn when she like had this whole relationship with these doctors that were like, she was basically like on her deathbed and on her pregnancy bed at the same time. And fortunately she survived and it all worked out, but they were like demanding Andre come to Philly and report when he had no interest in being there. He didn't want to move his wife. And amid all of that, and they were fining him to get there, like that really rubbed a lot of people the wrong way too. When they traded for Kirilenko, Sam had told Billy King, who was the GM in Brooklyn at the time, that they were just going to waive him. So stuff like that behind the scenes definitely encouraged what was happening, or encouraged the outrage from what was happening publicly, where, you know, he wasn't talking to the media. And you guys know it as well as I do that Sam was really willing to talk off the record. He's a really charming, personable, funny guy, I think. But the local media wasn't doing that. And I do agree to a certain extent that if you're not going to talk on the record, what is the value of talking to you? But I mean, if you're trying to build relationships with sources, that's one thing. If you're trying to actually cover the team, that's another. But I mean, the Jahlil situation is a perfect example of this. Like, he got in that Boston fight, he played and he played, and the league office is sitting there like, what are you doing? How is this guy popping up on TMZ? And then, you know, the Inquirer and Comcast Sportsnet and whoever are reporting all these other traffic violations and some guy pointing a gun at him through the window. And the team is doing nothing. Finally, when they do suspend him, it's Brett Brown talking about it before a pregame at Madison Square Garden where Sam is at the game but refusing to talk to reporters. Like, that is publicly what I think ultimately pushed him out of the door, but it was like the top of the surface, right? Like all the stuff I just talked about behind the scenes was kind of coloring that perspective as well. So I think looking back on it, he also definitely does recognize that those were his shortcomings. He probably could have been a bit more transparent. He only spoke after the draft and after the trade deadline, right? Like, we don't see, I mean, Daryl's on Twitter left and right, and other GMs go on radio shows and shake hands and kiss babies pregame and postgame and whatnot. Sam wasn't going to do any of that because he thought it was, you know, a competitive disadvantage. He wanted to hold all his cards close to his chest. But at the same time, you kind of have to sacrifice some competitive advantages, I think, to just create a good personality, reputation, and relationships around the league, because the NBA is a workplace at the end of the day. And you got to work with these guys, these agents, these other rival executives time and time again. And that was something that I think he really did struggle with.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to sum it up. While we have you here, can we do 5 minutes on that Pacers piece you wrote the other day?
There's some things I won't say, but yeah, let's do it.
It's just been the story of the NBA this week, I think, with, you know, there being rumblings about Nate Bjorkgren not, communicating as much with their players. And then there's the crazy thing this week. I mean, the timing was insane, where they have this on-court blow-up that goes viral with Greg Foster, former Sixers assistant Greg Foster, and Goga. Whatever you can say, you have a very detailed piece at Bleacher Report about the things that kind of, you know, the lack of communication and where that's kind of gone wrong. I guess just, what did you learn from the reporting of that piece?
Yeah, I mean, back in February even, and especially around the deadline, words started popping up that it just wasn't going well, and that very few players were still behind him, and that there was just a lot of turmoil based off of his communication style. And I started reporting on it quietly the last couple of weeks. And when Woj broke the news on Tuesday, it was like, all right, this is go time to get these details out, especially because the details weren't coming out, right? Like, I thought it was fair to the Pacers fan base. I mean, as cliche and corny as it is to say, like, when reporting is coming out that your head coach, your first year head coach, is likely going to be fired because of his abrasive communication style that has put off players and coaches, like, I think it's only fair for that fan base to get some examples of that, right? So, I worked the phones. I talked to over 15 people for that story, 3 people in the Pacers organization. And it just sounds like this is the way that Nate Bjorkgren has operated dating back to his G League time. I mean, I only quoted one of his former G League players. And I know a certain coach in Toronto called out the reporting because they were all anonymous quotes. But I mean, to talk about a person's personality and his job security, I mean, no one's really going to attach their name to that, right? Like, you kind of have to grant anonymity due to the sensitivity of that. I talked to a former G League player who I trust and I've known for a long time. And even after the story went out, I mean, I had literally over a dozen people on the league text me saying, yeah, I've heard similar things about that guy. And I saved a lot of details that were even worse, to be fully candid, to protect the people involved, even though I did kind of put them on blast. You know, I did save a lot of more inflammatory quotes and information. I knew that story was going to be explosive. I wanted it to be, you know, a Category 4 hurricane, not a Category 5, if you will. So, it's unfortunate. Like, honestly, I feel bad for everyone involved. I always say, like, I want everyone in the NBA to be successful. And the fact that they aren't in a situation right now, and they did hire Nate to have them be a Nick Nurse type and push them from being, you know, a good playoff team to a contender, and it's had the exact opposite effect, and they might fall out of the play-in tournament altogether. It's unfortunate, and I just think those details needed to come to light. Someone was going to report them at some point, and I had a beat on it for a couple weeks, so the Goga thing also just kind of, I mean, I'd heard that Greg Foster was, you know, and this is another example. And I wrote that Greg Foster was the coach that was still around that was starting to get the most frustrated. All I'll say is the behavior that he exhibited towards Goga, I think, has been behavior that has been exhibited towards him, if you catch my drift.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it just goes to show that as much as coaching, you know, people freak out about rotations and, you know, end of game play calls and things like that, a lot of it is just like, can you manage the personalities? And that's, you know, I think a lot of coaches would tell you that's like 90% of the job. And I just thought, you know, that great report, obviously, but they, the part that I thought hit home to me the most was that, like, the Pacers did not do quite as much research on that part with Nate Bjorkgren. You know, in looking for a Nick Nurse type, well, Nick Nurse, the Raptors knew who Nick Nurse was as a person because he had been their assistant coach for multiple years at that point. You know, that's cautionary tale.
Yeah, that's also why I felt I could write it and I felt I would be able to write it, is that, like, it was widespread. Like, everyone in the NBA has been talking about this for a while, and it's just so well known, and it was well known beforehand. Like, Phoenix situation and the G League situation, it's something that I'm a little surprised. I mean, then again, like I wrote in the story, you know, he was very positive and super energetic, and by all accounts, like in training camp and in after they had that hot start, like people were drinking the Kool-Aid and buying in. But then you're right, like his real personality shone through. And I think what I tell people all the time who ask me like what it's like covering the NBA, I always tell them, like, basketball is very little of the equation in the NBA. Like, sure, it's everything, but it's also kind of very, very small when you think of the factors that drive coaching changes and trades and whatever. It's a workplace, and it's an ecosystem, and it's personalities blending together. I mean, that's why Ben and Joel's relationship has been such a talking point, you know, for how long it's been. And I think the NBA is this huge behemoth that between 48 and zero on the clock, that is 1% of what happens. The actual games are very, very, very little of, you know, the whole iceberg of what it, you know, goes on behind the scenes in organizations.
And it provides a nice parallel to Hinkie's extended coaching search in 2013 and how they ended up with Brett Brown.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he wanted somebody that could be a partner and a teacher and a nurturer. I mean, I teased it at the top, but there's this really awesome anecdote in the book about Dell Demps, you know, the former Pelicans GM who actually made the trade with Sam for Nerlens and Drew. He was a Spurs exec at the time, and the Spurs had a lap pool in their practice facility because Tim Duncan loved to swim, and, you know, great form of cardio exercise, right? And one day Brett was walking through, and he saw Dell kind of like doggy paddling and floundering in the water. And Brett was like, "You don't know how to swim, man." And Dell was like, "Yeah, I do." He's like, "Nah, I'm going to meet you here tomorrow. I'm going to teach you how to swim." And like for weeks, Brett would come in early. And before practice, they would get in the pool wearing, you know, their Spurs practice, you know, t-shirts and shorts. And Brett taught him how to swim. And like, even though Greg Popovich and R.C. Buford and Tim Duncan were coming in, making fun of him, that's the kind of teacher and, you know, nurturer that Brett is. And I thought that example was just like a perfect example of the kind of guy that Sam knew he was going to get. And obviously, you know, Brett's tenure kind of came to a close in Philly because he never really exhibited the ability to turn all that into, you know, true postseason success. But I mean, he did a lot in Philly and helped grow those guys and put them in the position to be in there are now. And I think, it's unfortunate how his tenure ended, but I think his fingerprints on that franchise are also kind of indelible too.
So I lied. I have one more question. Maybe two. So first, you have an anecdote in there where early on in Brett's tenure, they're trying to get them not only to run more in transition, but a lot of early offense drills where they're, you know, basically have an 8 or a 10 second shot clock to try to encourage, you know, early actions in their plays. And Brett used to yell out butter because it was like the shot clock melting away.
Yes.
When you were being told that story, did any player or coach try to imitate Brett's accent while telling you that story? And were any of them even close to nailing it?
You know who was pretty good at impersonating it was Manu Ginobili. Which, I mean, someone gave me Manu's number and I called it and I was like, there's no way he's going to answer. It's Manu Ginobili. Where is he in the world right now, right? Like, he might be in Italy, he might be in Argentina. Sure enough, I called him up and he just answered. And we have like a great 25-minute conversation about Brett, and they were really close. from Brett's, you know, international experience and obviously Manu's background, and he called it his Australian accent, and he definitely gave me a really good impersonation. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Oh, what I would give for that tape. That's great. Yeah, I could just imagining Brett running down the court yelling butter. It just backed me up while
reading.
Butter. Yeah. The other one, so a part of the book obviously was in 2016 when they were going through the whole front office reorg. Did you get any real sense, you know, you reported that he was working, you know, talking that Hinkie was talking to Danny Ferry to potentially go over what a power structure would look like. Mm-hmm. Did you get any sense that that could have actually come to pass, or was that just early stages? This is better than teaming up with Brian, obviously, but do you think there was any chance that could have actually worked out?
I think with Danny, it might have been able to work out because of the Brett Brown connection. They'd been with San Antonio, and Brett, by all accounts, I mean, I'm sure Derek, you can attest to this too, Rich too, that him and Sam really were partners. Like, as much as they would ever disagree on certain things, you know, like trading MCW or like whatever.
The point guard situation definitely annoyed Brett.
Especially 15-16 with the whole Tony Roten and Kendall Marshall thing. But they were partners and they believed in each other, I think. And Brett really wanted it to work out with Sam. And that's why he was really pushing for Danny, because they knew each other from, you know, the San Antonio days, like I said. And maybe Danny would have been able to have done it, because he's not, you know, the type of bombastic, I'm a relationship type guy that the Colangelos are. But I mean, never really got a chance to get off the ground once, you know, the whole Luol Deng situation really came in to be a factor. From what I was told, it sounds like I was pretty surprised how late in the picture the Luol Deng situation came into those conversations in Philly.
Yeah.
Like, it seemed like they didn't really talk about it until the 11th hour. But Sam came in with the idea that he had a direct path to ownership, and they empowered him to do as he pleased and as he thought would push the team towards the ultimate one day goal of competing year after year after year. And I think any notion opposite of that was kind of untenable moving forward, especially with someone who was Jerry's son. And any situation where it was Jerry versus Sam, there would have been a third vote, and it wouldn't have gone Sam's way, obviously. And, you know, talk to anybody around the league. Sure, there are GMs and assistant GMs or presidents and general managers who have worked together forever, like Danny Ainge and Mike Zarin, or, you know, Gerson Rosas was Daryl's guy after Sam left for a long time. Calvin Booth and Tim Connolly are doing great things together in Denver. But there isn't a co-GM situation. Like, that's virtually unheard of. It's never, ever happened. And he put that into the equation where Sam was the guy and maybe even had more, you know, solo power than any GM at the time, and had all this carte blanche to just do as he chose and trade MCW, trade for JaVale McGee and take on that contract and then cut him a day after. I don't think it was tenable, and I think Philly knew that as well. Like, I don't think ownership they say they wanted to work around. I'm sure they did, because they did trust Sam. I did think he was brilliant, but I also think they knew he wouldn't have loved that situation. And I think that's also why Sam isn't back in the league. I think he realized that even when an ownership group tells
I don't think he would ever trust an ownership group again.
Exactly. I think there are very rare circumstances where, you know, Danny Ainge in Boston or Pat Riley in Miami or RC Buford in San Antonio, I think very, very rarely do owners and their top executives have such a trusting relationship. And I think that's the ultimate factor why he won't be back.
Yeah, I agree. All right. That sounds like a good place to cut it off. Thank you so much for your time. I didn't expect this to necessarily be an hour. I'm sorry for wasting it.
I did.
But go buy the book, Built to Lose, How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever. Go meet Jake during one of his book signings if you can. And it was great. And once again, just one more time, where are you going to be on Monday?
Liberty Grounds. I don't remember exactly where it is in the city, but 4 to 6 p.m., brand new bar, a buddy of mine from high school. They're opening it up just for us. They close on Mondays, so it'll be very, very spaced. And the other thing, if people send me the receipt of the book. I've got a bunch of old signed jerseys that I'm raffling off. I've got a signed Moses Malone and a signed Mo Cheeks and a signed Andre Iguodala. And I have like funny tchotchkes, like an Eric Snow snow globe and a Charles Barkley Duckley rubber ducky. And so I have a funny Jahlil Okafor bobblehead. So send me your receipt and you'll be in the mix.
I wrote a story about the Eric Snow snow globe not too long ago.
Did you really?
You have one. I did. Well, I mentioned it in a story. Yeah.
So, okay. I have no idea where it came from. I just had it in my, I went home around Thanksgiving to pack up my parents' house. They're moving, my childhood home. And I just like raided my old closet and took all this crap and said, all right, I can do something with this to promote the book. So yeah.
Sounds good. I will see you. I will stop by on Monday. I'm bringing my copy. I want that thing signed for a collectible, but thank you, Jake, for jumping on, and best of luck.
Thanks, Jake.
Thank you, guys.